From Maine Public Radio and mainepublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty with the news on this day in Maine, Tuesday, June 9th, 2020.
This Day in Maine is made possible by Modern Pest Services, committed to offering eco-friendly pest control solutions. Learn more at modernpest.com.
The State Center for Disease Control is investigating a possible outbreak of COVID-19 at Abbott Labs in Scarborough, which manufactures tests for the disease. CDC Director Dr. Nirav Shah says the company of 600 employees has been testing workers weekly since the beginning of the pandemic and has reported 23 cumulative cases since then.
But occasional cases had been detected. What we saw in our data was an uptick just in the past few days, which meets our threshold for when we've detected an outbreak.
Shaw says 5 cases have been confirmed since May 31st, which is just above the 3-case threshold to qualify as an outbreak. He says the company's taken steps to make sure its testing equipment has not been contaminated. The Maine CDC testing program uses some Abbott Labs testing, but much of its recent testing expansion has been through a partnership with IDEX. The CDC is reporting today 18 new cases of COVID-19 for a total number of 2,606. The CDC also says today the 100th person has died since the pandemic began. The leader of the largest union at Navy shipbuilder Bath Iron Works says workers are ready to strike if the company doesn't return to the negotiating table with a suitable offer. The current contract covering the 4,300 local S6 members at BIW expires at noon on June 21st. And a coalition of business and nonprofit organizations is calling on Maine voters to support a $15 million internet infrastructure bond that will be on the ballot next month. The new group says the bond money plus an additional $30 million in matching public and private funds will create jobs and bolster development in underserved areas of the state. Nick Batista is the senior policy officer for the Island Institute. He says increased broadband access will improve educational opportunities for students and families, particularly in rural communities.
Other communities, they find it unacceptable that school children must sit at the library steps at night to do their homework. And in some communities, businesses struggle to attract employees because of the lack of reliable internet makes it difficult for a spouse to find work.
The bond question is one of two that will appear on the July 14th ballot. Voters will also decide whether to approve a $105 million transportation bond. In weather tonight, partly to mostly cloudy with lows in the low 40s to the mid 50s. Tomorrow, partly to mostly sunny with highs in the 60s to the mid 70s. Thursday, foggy with showers and highs in the low 60s to the mid 70s. Democratic Senate candidate Sarah Gideon skipped a televised primary debate last night, and Republican House candidate Eric Brakey says he'll also pass on a broadcast debate tomorrow. Some political science scholars say that is a risk for campaigns as voters want to see candidates debate the issues. Mal Leary has more.
Both campaigns say they do plan to participate in other debates and forums before the July 14th primary. And that's why, says Dan Shea, who chairs the government department at Colby College. Shea says he understands why some frontrunners can be reluctant to face off against opponents, because while debates and primaries can help solidify their base of support, there's also pressure to expand that base for the general election.
The double-edged sword is, on the one hand, you want to turn out your base, and debates during primaries can do that. But on the other hand, you need to win over persuadable, sort of moderate voters.
And Shea says the open nature of a debate may also allow opponents to push the leading candidate to take positions that may hurt them in the fall. But refusing to take part in debates, he says, carries a risk of upsetting voters. And University of Southern Maine political science professor Ron Schmidt says this is a most unusual election year.
You know, generally speaking, political scientists will tell you that, especially at this point, no one's really paying attention. But this year, and this as in most other things, is different. People are paying close attention to what candidates are doing, and they have some big expectations.
Other political scientists interviewed for this story say that skipping some primary debates may not be an issue with most voters. But refusing to take part in debates and forums in the fall could have consequences. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Mal Leary.
While some campground and hotel owners in Maine say they are encouraged by the state's announcement of an alternative to its 14-day quarantine rule, some are still trying to figure out how to properly enforce the protocols. Yesterday, Governor Janet Mills announced that instead of quarantining for 2 weeks after coming into Maine, out-of-staters could also certify that they've tested negative for COVID-19. Travis Ferlin, the owner of the Rangeley Inn, says the additional option should give customers more flexibility and make it easier for out-of-staters to visit. But he says it will still be hard to fully enforce those measures, which is why he has put additional safety precautions in place to make his property safer.
So we've gone above and beyond with that layer. Just in case somebody is disingenuous in their certification, you know, we still have the ability to make sure we're protecting everybody and keeping everybody safe on our property.
Mills says under the new plan, the state will also increase symptom checks in popular tourist destinations and fund local efforts to limit the spread of the virus. To get some context on the new rule, we spoke with Lindsay Wiley. Wiley's the director of American University's Health Law and Policy Program and the author of several books on public health law. She spoke with our Morning Edition host, Erwin Gratz.
So there is still some risk in this plan, even if there's perfect compliance with it. You know, compliance is really a concern with any kind of public health intervention. The travel quarantine for 14 days also depended a lot on people telling the truth about what they were doing and complying because they knew that they should do the right thing to protect other people in the community. On the second question about the effectiveness of requiring a test within 72 hours, you know, there is still a concern, and it's a concern that the governor's office and the state health department raised when they defended the 14-day quarantine in court. And that concern is that if people pick up the infection while they're en route because of the incubation period, even if every traveler into Maine has been tested or will quarantine when they arrive, there's some risk that may miss some cases. What you're trying to protect in Maine is not that you are completely free from the virus, but that you have low levels of it that are manageable within your hospital capacity. You know, my hope would be that the people of Maine and the businesses of Maine will understand that this is a fluid situation, and that if the hospitals do start to face a situation where they can't cope with cases, that those orders may change and the restrictions may become more strict.
Yeah. There is this idea that these requirements will not be in place for folks from New Hampshire or Vermont. And I guess I'm not 100% clear why that would be. Is it simply because the virus seems to be less prevalent among the populations of those two states?
Yeah, I think we see actually quite a lot of areas like Maine that are dependent on tourism trying to identify other jurisdictions that are similarly affected by the virus as the jurisdiction that would receive the travelers. You know, the idea with a travel limit in a situation where the virus has been contained in one location is that you have to have very strict adherence to it. You know, if even one case gets through to an area where the virus is not in circulation, that has big consequences. But again, that's not the situation that Maine is in right now. The virus is there in the state. It's just been, fortunately, at reasonable, manageable levels, at least within hospital capacity.
All right. And then the last piece of this, of course, is the enhanced education. Based on what we've seen in the last few months, if you do flood an area with the messaging about social distancing and hand washing and all the other steps that one can take to be protective, does it seem to make a difference in how much people comply?
I think it's hard to know how much the messaging makes that difference versus just knowing about the situation and knowing about how serious this virus has been for many people in this country. I tend to really value nudges that just help remind people in their everyday goings-on about town that they should be maintaining social distance, even more than an education campaign like, you know, radio ads reminding people to maintain social distance. I actually really like the idea of things like you know, using tape markings or signage on the floor in places where people are waiting in line, signage reminding them to wear masks. Even better would be providing masks as much as possible, particularly if they're the more effective kind of masks than some homemade masks might be. I think those measures probably play an even more important role than just sort of public information campaigns to follow public health guidelines.
In other words, make it easier for people to comply.
Exactly. What we like to say in public health is to make the healthy choice the easy choice.
And that's American University's Health Law and Policy Program Director Lindsay Wiley speaking with Morning Edition host Erwin Gratz. Immigrant communities in Maine are especially vulnerable to COVID-19, in part because many immigrants live in close quarters and have large families, and because many are essential workers. As part of its monitoring of COVID-19 in Maine, the State Department of Human Services tracks race and ethnicity of all cases through its contact tracing system. And as Liana Amayez, the department's manager of diversity, equality, and inclusion, told Maine Calling's Jennifer Rooks, the numbers are cause for concern.
We're seeing some really stark disparities and things worth noting. So if you look, Black and African-American people in Maine only make up less than 20,000 people in our population, and yet make up 20.9% of all known COVID-19 cases. So relative to their population share, those are really dramatic numbers, as we're seeing. There's also some disproportionate numbers being seen for the Hispanic population, though not quite as extreme. Hispanics make up about 1.6% of our population, but 2.8% of our cases. The largest disparity is certainly seen within the Black and African American community.
Liana, we've already talked about some of the reasons for a high COVID cases among immigrant communities, namely that so many are essential workers and also that so many people live in such close quarters. Are there other reasons?
Right. That's the question that we are trying to understand in concert with many of our community partners and in coming together to understand how they're being impacted. I think what we see is that COVID-19 hasn't necessarily created these disparities, but laid bare disparities that already exist, disparities in access to health care, disparities in the types of professions that people work in and the conditions in which people live, which ultimately leave them more susceptible to infectious disease. The question is, how do we respond to COVID-19 in a way that helps us to respond to the immediate crisis, but also start to address some of those disparities that are actually leading to the disparities that we're seeing in the data?
What is DHHS doing now differently than before in trying to address some of these disparities and keep more immigrants safe?
I think the number one thing is listening to the communities, first and foremost. We've started to do some regular stakeholder engagement throughout all of our offices, really seeing that as an important part of government, but specifically around the disparities that we're seeing with COVID-19, bringing together a range of leaders and advocates for people of color, New Mainers, and our tribes on a regular basis to hear their concerns and begin to address those, using those concerns to inform our work. I also want to I certainly want to mention the work also of our CDC district public health liaisons who work and engage with a number of community-based organizations on a regular basis, but during this crisis have been pulling together groups of folks based on regional access and really listening to how different groups have been affected and trying to bring them together to problem solve, working with right now we are working with CAP agencies and Catholic Charities to help fund and subcontract with some of those community-based organizations to ensure that we're providing culturally and linguistically appropriate education. So not just translating documents coming out of the CDC, but also really making sure that they're getting to communities in ways that make sense for those communities and that people are able to work with local community health workers to get information, get to testing, and get support so that they can remain in isolation or quarantine when that's necessary.
And that's Liana Amayez, the department's manager of diversity, equity, and inclusion, speaking with Maine Calling's Jennifer Rooks. You can find more information about COVID-19 in Maine, including breakdowns by race and ethnicity, at the Maine CDC website. And that's today's Maine News. For more stories, visit mainepublic.org and join us tomorrow on Maine Calling at 1 o'clock for a look at the latest medical understanding of COVID-19. I'm Nora Flaherty.